Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey guys, you ever wonder what Phil and I wear while we podcast? You can find out if you join our Patreon. We'll also be talking about the films of 1989, but that's definitely less important than seeing our Zoom backgrounds, our headphone choices, and our sweatshirts.
It's true. It's true. You'll get to see all the various pieces of artwork that I have framed on my office wall, and you can see Kenny's garden, sort of. So that's something. That's exciting.
It's a hanging garden.
It's a hanging garden. But perhaps more important than anything, we are doing this Patreon to cover the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, with amazing guests like Tom Meissen, Liz Hanna, Joanna Robinson, Brian Cogman, Chuck Hayward. You can sign up at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. And for $5, you'll get access to all the audio of these fantastic episodes. For a few bucks more, you'll get video as well of our 99 and 89 episodes. And perhaps, most importantly, you'll be supporting us so we can just keep making podcast content for you guys.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999, hanging from the gallows here in 2021. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybar.
And I'm Philoscope.
And with us today is Simon Ennis. Nice to see you, Simon.
Hi, boys. How you doing?
Well, you know, we're very calm. It seems that the Zoom or the internet has an issue with the timbre of my voice. And every time
Here's what's great. For our listeners, there were two previous takes, and we got a different form of execution for each of the takes, which I appreciated, and I think Simon did as well.
Yeah, I'm really glad that one worked, because spoiler alert, the next one would have been from like Auschwitz.
Wasn't gonna do that one. That was it. If that one didn't work, we were going back to the top. But yeah, so for some reason, the internet has cut me off. So if that happens over the course of this podcast, we'll do it live. Simon, great to see you. Got to talk about Mr. Death, the rise and fall of Fred Lecter,
I think.
Lecter is how he seems to say it in the film. But then when Nazis are saying his name, they say Leuchter.
Which is
more German, but I think Lecter is the sort of general Americanized pronunciation.
That feels right.
But my sense is he probably would have gone on to adopt the Nazi pronunciation of his own American name.
Feels right. That feels right.
This is a documentary. It's Errol Morris, the great documentarian, has an incredibly interesting career. For instance, I didn't know he was just a Long Island boy. Did you guys know that?
No.
He's just kind of your average everyday Long Island boy who's made like seven or eight world-changing documentaries.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, this is certainly one of them. Simon, thank you for coming back to this pod to talk about this one.
Oh, my pleasure. I always get my favorite directors, David Lynch the first time, Errol Morris this time. So, yeah.
Do you, Simon, think that, I mean, Errol Morris feels, he's in the pantheon of what, like top five, top three documentarians ever, right? In terms of how he sort of revolutionized the format. Would you agree with that?
Oh yeah, easily. Easily top five. I mean, I don't know how you'd rank them, but definitely one of the absolute giants of it. And I mean, in a way, he probably has done the most to, you know, to just create the feel of what documentary looks like now. Like every Netflix documentary, every HBO documentary just has his fingerprints all over it. And that sort of started with his movie, The Thin Blue Line, which was kind of the first documentary to actually have like stylish reenactments in it, which is now everywhere, and kind of grew. But like, you know, Mr. Death, I watched it again yesterday, as I know did you on Holocaust Remembrance Day, which was very apt. But like at the time, most documentaries didn't look anything like that. And now basically all of them do.
Yeah. So here's another sort of, because like we've done a couple documentaries on this podcast. All of them I've enjoyed and all of them I found really interesting. Mm-hmm. But I feel like one of the sort of hallmarks of Errol Morris' stuff isn't just that he picks subjects that are, I don't want to say, strange is the wrong word, but off the beaten path. People that you wouldn't expect necessarily to have a documentary made about them. And he doesn't pass judgment on his characters or on his subjects, which I feel like a lot of documentarians tend to have, I mean, for not to put too fine a point on it, but a little bit of an axe to grind. They have a thing that they want to say and they have a thesis statement and they're going to get that across to you. I left this film, and I would say the majority of his films, always sort of unsure as to how I'm supposed to feel about the subjects. Would you agree?
Yeah. I mean, I think that he definitely does have things he wants to say about his subjects. This case, Lucha, absolutely. But he doesn't so much as hit you over the head with what he wants to say. He directs you in ways that gets you asking questions. And I think that that's a wonderful thing. And that is a huge part of his MO. So I think what he wants to do is, you know, present this guy and not say, oh, he's bad, he's bad, he's bad, but allow him to say all this crazy shit and tell you his insane story and how he went from designing various execution machines to becoming a neo-Nazi darling. And gives and, you know, lets us make up our own mind. I think it's very clear that Errol Morris, who is like a liberal Jew, who is, you know, a philosopher and a very thoughtful academic guy, you know, what he thinks of it, of the subject. But, you know, he's a more intelligent filmmaker. He wants us to, you know, make our own judgments, ask our own questions,
sure,
you know, think for ourselves.
All right. Well, you know, I'm going to disagree.
Yeah.
Not unilaterally. I think the Robert McNamara movie, for instance.
Sure.
The Fog of War.
Fog of War, yeah.
Very much follows what you're talking about, Phil, and what you're talking about, Simon, where he kind of lets this guy come to his own conclusions over the course of the documentary about what he was involved in. Yeah. And I do think that is probably Errol Morris's goal with a lot of these movies, that you see the full, you know, the full breadth of these people. But there is some sort of revelation within the context of the movie. There certainly is within The Thin Blue Line, which is, you know, kind of, it's not only revolutionary for the way it was shot and the reenactments, like they actually changed the case. They actually like found a different outcome of this case and to overturn the case. You know, which again, I don't think that's what Errol Morris set out to do. I feel that he probably felt he had a journalistic responsibility to present what he found. Kind of like, you know, we saw with the Jakes on HBO. He doesn't have a journalistic imperative in this movie to include the other historian rebutting Fred Leitcher at every step. Mm-hmm. That is editorializing, which, by the way, totally fine. But that's editorializing. And if it weren't for that guy, I think this movie would be dangerous, actually. So I think it's the right move in this particular case. But I was worried for a while before they introduced the other guy that we wouldn't have somebody presenting the alternate viewpoint, because it's very scary to have anybody presenting a unfettered view of something like Holocaust denialism, no matter what the person making behind the camera's point of view is. So that puts way too much trust in a audience that we know is very suggestible.
Well, the really interesting thing about that, I mean, you're totally right. And I was actually sort of going to say that with Phil's point, I actually think that this one does have the most judgment for those reasons that you just said, Kenny. Very interesting thing about this. And I think I knew it way back when, but I read a little bit about it in the last day or two. Originally, Lucher's voice was going to be the only voice in an
early
cut of the film. His voice was going to be the only voice there. There were none of these. There was no historian Holocaust expert. There wasn't the guy in the lab. There wasn't Ernst Zundel.
Really?
There wasn't any of those things. It was only going to be Fred. And that sort of goes to show the tightrope that Errol Morse walks, because the reason he was going to do that is because he actually was giving the audience too much of the benefit of the doubt.
Right,
he thought that it would be clear to anybody that, well, of course, the Holocaust happened. In one interview I read with him talking about it, he said, it's like, well, I mean, I don't have to prove that the sky is blue, so I didn't think I had to prove this. But when he started showing that early cut to people, they were like, exactly what you said, like, this could go very wrong. Not everybody will get this immediately. And so the first person he brought in was this historian to, you know, just very clearly refute absolutely all of the complete foolish bullshit that Lucher,
I mean,
you know,
it's
takes as evidence.
It's amazing to, you know, I was texting with both of you individually, obviously, about this a little bit. And Simon and I texted a little last night about sort of the parallels to sort of the QAnon world that we live in right now, and disinformation and the various things that are out in the world. And it is it's terrifying, obviously, but this is a perfect example of that. The sense that he was like, well, of course I can put this out, because it's absurd that anyone would believe that this didn't happen. And yet there are people that's like, if they see it on a TV screen or they see it on a movie screen, they immediately take it as fact. Without doing any sort of, you know, thought on their own. Which kind of leads me back to Fred and the lack of thought that he put into his journey. Do you know what I mean? Like the willingness to just it's the sort of deluding himself, the manipulation of science in his own head to buy into this thing is just fascinating.
Hey, table Fred for one second.
Yeah, sure.
I just want to get back to this idea of the willingness to buy in, because I think it's something a little even more insidious than you see it on the screen and therefore people are willing to believe it. There's this strain through America, and this movie to me proves, even though there's so many examples from history, but this movie to me proves as a primary document, this well precedes QAnon, or even things like Loose Chains, a 9/11 documentary, that quote unquote documentary that claims, you know, it was inside job, where people, a massive swath of this country, doesn't want to believe what they are taught by authoritative experts. There is this belief that is inside of something that they are not. And documents like Loose Change or document QAnon stuff or stuff like Alex Jones's show are the actual truth that's being held from them by some kind of insider. And that is a psychology that I truly can't understand. Mm-hmm. I understand it exists. And assuming that there's a conspiracy that lies you at every level, from the top level of your government to the teacher aide in your classroom. That's very strange to me.
Yeah, I keep coming back to sort of just distrust. I don't, it feels really just, It really, I mean, we were talking about this before about, you know, the current stock GameStop stuff that's going on, and just this, and I was talking about how, you know, I don't necessarily trust Reddit. I don't necessarily trust online communities because I just don't know how fact-based it is a lot of the time. It's not to say that they aren't good or bad or what have you. It's just, I just don't know what to make of it. So if I don't know what to make of it, my initial response is either to A, ignore it, or B, do more research so I feel like I at least have some sense of an understanding of whatever the subject is. I think, unfortunately, a lot of people go the opposite way, which is they don't trust it, they don't understand it, and they fully believe what is put in front of them.
Well, a healthy skepticism
sure
is good when you're approaching yeah anything, right? And I think you're taking the right approach. What's happened in this country that legitimately, you know, scares the shit out of me is, and I think this movie does a really good job of kind of showing the two levels of this. There are people who are profiting off of this. There are people who are profiting off the misinformation and who probably know better. I would put a guy like Lee Atwater in that group, or I would put a guy like Karl Rove in that group. People who know that they're playing upon, you know, this percentage of the population who are willing to believe these alternate facts. And I don't think we ever had a president who truly believed it until Trump. And what scared me about Trump was he was a true believer. It scared me about Sarah Palin was that she was a true believer, right? Where she was actually regurgitating the lies with the full force of someone who believes them as truth. And what's scary about the QAnon movement is it seems to be run by true believers. What's scary potentially to be run by true believers. And that because I don't know if this Holocaust denier was the main guy who was in jail and on trial in Canada was a true believer, but Fred Leicher wound up becoming that. He wound up truly believing that the Holocaust didn't happen, or at least didn't happen as they said it happened. And those people are the dangerous people.
For sure.
Those people who can take a polygraph, who can stand in front of a group yeah of people, who can tell you this is how it really is, and you can tell, you know, their sincerity. Yeah. That's when it gets very scary.
Well, you know, I'm very curious as to your thoughts, both of your thoughts on this, because I as I was watching it yesterday, first and foremost, when I saw it in 99, for whatever reason, I believed that the Holocaust denying was kind of like a third act twist. I didn't realize it came in so early in the film. Like it's
most
about
of
half
the movie.
Hour into the, yeah, it's most of the movie. It's like a half hour into the movie. So that also kind of blew my mind a little bit. But watching it yesterday, I just wish that I could understand why he went into his I don't know what the best sort of him when he goes to the concentration camps to look at them to figure out whether or not they existed or whatever the case might be. I just don't really understand the mindset. It's almost like he went in with a preconceived notion, like that he needed to prove what this guy wanted him to prove. Rather than going there with a scientific mind, he seemed to go there with the approach of how do I defend this man's notions of the Holocaust? Am I crazy in that?
Well, he was definitely leaning that way.
Okay. Okay.
I think it's two things. Number one, you know, he says that he, and this is totally echoed these days on the right, when it used to be a left-wing issue, but has now basically been usurped as a right-wing issue. He was trying to be a free speech warrior. He was saying, like, you know, I'm American, and you know, this guy has the right to, you know, has the right to free speech. He should be able to say and publish whatever he wants. So he was definitely tipped towards Ernst Zundel at the time. What I think is so fascinating about this is that this is a guy, I mean, it's sort of a reverse American dream story. This is a guy who teaches himself how to be an engineer. He's not credited, as we find out later on. He's not actually licensed to be an engineer. He somehow sort of through his own, you know, his own hard work really and ambition gets to redesign this electric chair. And then as he moves from working from one state to another state to another state in their various, various ways of executing people. He's bestowed this accreditation of being an expert. He was not an expert in lethal injection machines. He made a electric chair. And just because of that, another state said, well, you can make this lethal injection machine. And then because
he just
of that,
made like a headpiece. It was like the headpiece, and the governor was like, "Well, this guy knows what he's doing." Well,
yeah, it's crazy. So he basically builds himself up from nothing, is bestowed this expertise that's increasing and increasing and increasing. And then when this other group comes in that happened to be neo-Nazis in Canada that are willing to bestow yet another expertise feather in his cap, he will take the attention. It seems like he's just on the rise, and he can also become a hero in the good old USA value of free speech. It's a totally wild nightmare American dream story that's completely fucked up and weird. And I think to your point as well. So there's the acceptance part of it, but also I think that there's a line later on that the historian says that Holocaust denialism is a lot about vanity. Once you kind of get into this group, then everybody's kind of giving you the thumbs up. Everybody's agreeing with you. Everybody is everybody's kind of helping big each other up, and it becomes addictive. And you can completely see that in
like any other cult.
All of the, exactly. And in all the QAnon stuff that's happening now.
Yeah. I mean, like the KKK, like your grand wizard of racism. I would imagine that for a lifelong weirdo like Leitcher, that was probably pretty intoxicating. I think I want to run you through my journey with this movie real fast. I never saw it, and I didn't know what it was about. So the closest contact I think I had with it was probably when Siskel and Ebert reviewed it on the show, but I didn't remember the Holocaust denialism stuff. I thought it was about a guy who was, the guy who created execution methods. So imagine what that's like for me going into this movie and seeing this oddly charming, strange Woody Allen, Rick Moranis-y character who drinks 40 cups of coffee a day and smokes six cigarettes and is
six packs of cigarettes and is able to
in English without emotion. The apparatus with which he uses to humanely carry out executions, I was taken by the guy. Okay, and you could see it by my log. Like how I was thinking, okay, this movie would be really tough to watch if this guy wasn't so endlessly compelling, but fortunately he is. So I think that that's probably how do people look at the guy. And a lot of people found him kind of charming in his own little weird, wormy way. And the most charming thing about him, and it's a weird adjective to use, but I think it totally applies, is the reason he was so successful in his field was because his field was probably populated by total fucking monsters who didn't actually care. Sure. And the people who actually have to carry out these executions, wardens and prison guards, like he said in the movie, saw people that they know having their heads burned off. And that was probably hard to watch. His basic humanity, when he went towards this and said it's like, essentially it's revolting and inhumane to execute people in painful ways, and my job is to make it as humane as possible, I think is a save the cat moment. And that made me feel like, okay, this is a guy who might be working for the bad guys, but as long as he's it's a Mitt Romney thing. This is the kind of guy I want working for the bad guys. At least this is the kind of guy who I can trust to be right about some of the bigger things, like we don't kill people by like setting their hair on fire. So that I think that to some extent we don't give him enough credit for his, in my opinion, his fundamental decency. And that's what gets kind of perverted and gets abused as the movie goes on, you know, where he kind of got lost.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with everything you're saying. I remember that moment in the documentary and thinking, because he talks about, you know, humanity and that people are still deserving of a death that doesn't torture them. You know what I mean? Like this idea of that he's looking for the most quote unquote humane way to kill people. The way he talks about, it's terrifying to think about how many poorly executed people there are and have been in this country, ways that I can't even imagine. So I on some level, on a human level, appreciated that, Kenny, to your point, that like that there's a human being under this and that he's looking to try to do the quote unquote humane thing. And that kind of comes full circle a little bit at the end when he's gone through this journey. He's been vilified. He's basically been shunned from an industry you would think no one could be shunned from, which is the execution industry. He's found the one third rail, it seems, which is Holocaust denying, to make sure that he's no longer a part of this industry. And on some weird fucking part of me, I feel sorry for him. And it shouldn't be that way. I shouldn't feel that way. And yet I do. And that's sort of the weird fucking maelstrom that is this movie, which I think is tremendous.
The movie is a tragedy for those exact reasons. Yeah. And it's like the tragedy of a fool, basically. I mean, people say it in there that like somewhere along the lines, he sold his soul to the devil, you know, for attention or whatever. I mean, he certainly willingly did. Yeah. It's fun, like, Kenny, how you watched the movie, that's definitely how I watched it back then. That's how my wife, who watched it for the first time yesterday with me, saw it. She had no idea. And when Ernst Zundel and the Holocaust denialism stuff came in, she was just completely floored. Yeah. A working title for the film was actually called Accidental Nazi, which would have really kind of ruined
that's ruined a surprise. Twist.
And then Phil, with what you said earlier, I felt the exact same way. I didn't remember that this movie was two thirds about him getting involved in neo-Nazis. What you remember is you remember the electric chair, you remember the 40 cups of coffee, you remember all that stuff in the first third. And I was thinking about why that is, because I mean, I saw it in 99, probably a couple of times. I probably saw it again in the early 2000s, haven't seen it in 15 plus years. But I think that part of the reason that we remember it that way is because back in 1999, you know, salad days or idyllic times, neo-Nazis were not a going concern. It was one sad little tiny meeting room in a convention center out by the airport, which is where he's giving his talks. It wasn't, you know, in the White House. It wasn't, you know, on Reddit. It wasn't everywhere. It was kind of a thing that didn't really, you know, rear its ugly head all that much very publicly, as much as it does now. So now I think it actually delivers a much bigger punch. It's a lot more harrowing, a lot more disturbing now than it even was 22 years ago.
That's an interesting point and an interesting lesson. The bad elements never go away. They only hibernate. You know, I it's a very different kind of point, but I remember when The Sopranos came out thinking, well, this is fun, but the mafia is not a thing anymore, so we can kind of enjoy it. And lo and behold, the mafia is very much a thing, you know, like the mafia is a very big deal these days and never kind of ceased to be a big deal. They just kind of got smarter with their PR. I think that I think we can never stop being vigilant against things like Nazism or racism or any of these, you know, kind of oppressive isms that plague us.
Yeah, it's. I texted this to you, Simon, yesterday, but this film was upsetting in 99 for sure. But it was also oddly exciting in an Errol Morris sort of way. I thought it was a cool movie, as much as it could be under the circumstances. Watching it yesterday, it was straight up harrowing. Like and maybe more so than any film we've watched so far, Kenny, in terms of, I know you didn't watch it in 99, but just that the difference of how I viewed it. I mean, I'd say American Beauty is probably the only other one that genuinely has drastically changed in the way that I viewed it, or that I'm a different person now. The world's a different place. And seeing this film through that lens was a really powerful thing.
Well, I didn't know you had watched it in 99. I texted you right after because I knew this would affect you. I know you well, and I know you well enough to know that this is the kind of movie that might have some psychological.
It's pretty triggering. It was a little triggering.
I know. The irony is I find the word trigger to be so triggering. I try not to use it.
Fair point.
But I thought this might be triggering for you. Yeah. I'm happy you had seen it. You could adequately brace yourself.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I think that the irony, of course, is I thought I had braced myself is kind of the point. Like, I thought I saw it. And I was like, yeah, I remember this movie. Like, it's a guy who makes electric chairs. And then at the end, we find out he's a Holocaust denier. Like, what? And then it's over. And I was like, oh, no, it's an hour of Holocaust denying. And it was... It was a much harder watch, but at the same time, you know, it's a testament to Errol Morris, who makes these people palatable. He makes them watchable. He makes them human. And I mean, I think that that's ultimately always kind of his goal, which is humanizing people that you think are essentially unable to be humanized. I mean, that seems to be kind of the thing that he, or at least one of the things that he strives for. I think, you know, Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control, which might be my favorite of his movies, which is also just about a bunch of weirdos that he decides to kind of make a movie about. I don't know. This viewing made me want to watch more of his films. I've seen a lot of his films, but there's some that I haven't seen and he has a new one on Showtime right now about Timothy Leary, which I'm very interested to watch.
Yeah.
Psychedelic Love Story, I believe is what it's called. So he's a fascinating filmmaker. I want to just give a very quick synopsis for the people that haven't seen it, because I don't think a lot of people have. Documentary filmmaker Errol Morris investigates the case of a man who became an authority on capital punishment, but was discredited when he got involved on the wrong side of a court case. Lucher, a meek man whose appearance belies his grim expertise, develops what he says is a more effective electric chair. Before long, he's in demand from officials who want his opinions on other types of execution. But when called to aid the case of an accused Holocaust denier, Lucher's problems begin. Directed by Errol Morris, who did Gates of Heaven, Thin Blue Line, Brief History of Time, Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control, The Fog of War. Mr. Death opened on December 29th, 1999, against Stuart Little, Toy Story 2, The Talented Mr. Ripley, Any Given Sunday, and The Green Mile. It would go on to make around $500,000 in North America. It's got 100% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics. 87% from audiences. I'm just going to read a brief clip from Ebert's 4-star review where he said, "This is the 7th documentary by Errol Morris, who combines dreamlike visual montages with music by Caleb Sampson to create a movie that is more revere and meditation than reportage. Morris is drawn to subjects who try to control that which cannot be controlled, life and death. His heroes have included lion tamers, gardeners, robot designers, turkey callers, autistics, death row inmates, Pet Cemetery owners, and Stephen Hawking, whose mind leaps through space and time while his body slumps in a chair. Like all of Morris's films, Mr. Death provides us with no comfortable place to stand. We often leave his documentaries not sure if he liked his subjects or was ridiculing them. He doesn't make it easy for us with simple moral labels. Human beings, he argues, are fearsomely complex and can't get their minds around very strange ideas indeed. Sometimes it is possible to hate the sin and love the sinner. Poor Fred, what a dope, what a dupe. What a lonely, silly man." It's an apt review. I was not surprised, but also, I mean, 100% on Rotten Tomatoes for a movie that, for a documentary film that about a Holocaust denier and a executioner. Obviously not a box office hit, but I don't even think this film was nominated for Best Documentary, if I'm not mistaken. I don't believe that it was.
It was not. I just watched a 60 Minutes from when it came out, or I think maybe about a year when it came out. It was a really great profile of Errol Morris. They talked to Roger Ebert, who was basically the biggest Errol Morris fanboy in the world, for good reason. Apparently after this movie, Errol Morris was was brought into the Academy, joined the Academy because there were so many Academy members that were disgusted that he had never yet been nominated for best documentary after making like five of the best ones, that they basically gamed the system in a GameStop Redditor sort of way. And it was like, let's like, this guy has to be a member. And it wasn't until Fog of War, which was sort of his straightest film at the time, even though it's complex and it has all the stuff it has, that he was nominated. And I'm pretty sure he won an Oscar for that one as well. I'd say in that Ebert review, there's a thing that's even slightly more sort of right than what you said about humanizing these people, in that looking for the complexity within people is what he's doing, even more than just humanizing, you know, bad people or weirdos or whatever. The fast, cheap, and out of control subjects are very benevolent people. They're lovable and none of them do anything evil. Funnily enough, Fred Lupter was going to be the fifth in
Fast, really? Cheap,
and
out of control.
Took him out because I think that if I'm getting this quote correctly, he was starting to cut it together, and Morris's wife said to him, if you bring Hitler into the soup, Hitler isn't just a spice. Now it becomes Hitler soup. So so then he decided Hitler to take the movies. You know, have a sweeter movie about a robot scientist, a lion tamer, a topiary gardener, and then make his electric chair Hitler movie its own thing.
Yeah, I mean, she's totally right. It would have thrown the balance of the film off completely. But yeah, I don't know. Maybe this is just my little bubble that I live in, or my cinematic, you know, tunnel vision. But like, when I think documentaries, I think Errol Morris and Michael Moore. Like, those are the two guys. And I'm not equating them, because I have my issues with Michael Moore as a filmmaker, even if I really do like some of his films. It's just he defined the medium for me, and it seems like he defined it for a lot of people as well, and really changed the way that it was perceived. It's amazing to me that of course the fucking Academy needs to have their goddamn arm twisted before they even like let the guy in the door, but
it's what, you know, it's exactly what Simon was saying. He revolutionized the medium, and that's very scary for people who have been for years and years and years. I would say Michael Moore did that too. Oh, I mean, Roger and Me, I'm sure it was nominated, but it
didn't
win.
I don't believe it won. I think Columbine was his first win.
Yeah,
there you go. Columbine was his first win, and that was in 2002. And I think, you know, I think people found him very kind of scary.
Polarizing, sure. Yeah.
Not polarizing him for his politics, polarizing for making himself the central character of his movies.
Yeah.
That's not something that documentarians are comfortable with necessarily. And the ones you are, you have to really kind of wary of. And I think that that's a scary thing for some people, really just let the story come to that.
Yeah. And both of those guys, you know, in the wake of them, there's been thousands of imitators, some great, some, a lot of them horrible, and a lot of them kind of mediocre. I would definitely put both of them on the Mount Rushmore of documentary, along with Agnes Varda and Fred Wiseman for sure. You know, some other people.
Yeah, you mean the only other one that I think of are the Maisel brothers. You know what I mean? You know, and as a totally different type of documentary filmmaking for all intents and purposes. But yeah, I don't know. As I get older, I'm sure you guys have this as well, where there are things that you're just like, I wasn't particularly interested in documentaries or docuseries or that sort of things when I was younger. I know that Simon, you were. And that's awesome, but for a little more than me, anyway.
Not so much, yeah.
I've gotten older, and I don't know if this is just as you get older, you want more truth in your life, you want more things that feel, you know what I mean, like more bearing walls, things to hold on to. But I've just found myself watching more documentaries, reading more nonfiction as well, and just sort of for whatever reason, I've sort of found that very, very calming right now. For what that's worth, I don't know. But
what is
not
that?
This
including
movie,
including this movie?
Not this movie.
Well, Sorry, Kenny. Me too. Right. I almost exclusively read nonfiction now. I'm super bored by almost any novel I start. and I mean, last night I went to sleep listening to The Power Broker. So on a book on tape. So like that. That's how far I will go for nonfiction stuff. I don't know what it is. I don't want to say it's something as simple as, like, you know, it's an anthropological thing and we're trying to find out where we come from who we are and how everything happened, which I guess is part of it. True. And I guess part of it's the real of it, you know, like you said, the real of it, the undeniable facts of it, and then we can draw our own conclusions from it. But I don't know. I tend to kind of find these stories to be I'll give you my best guess. When I watch a scripted show or movie, as someone who does that, I am most excited by things that cut against my expectations, which I think all audiences are, but I think me in particular, I'd rather have a rattlesnake thrown into the middle of the room than have things go where they are. However, when a rattlesnake's thrown into the middle of a room, I yell, "There's a smackin' him! There's a smackin' him!" Because, like, I'm so in it. Like, I feel like I know the structures, but I also know the tricks, and it's very hard to fool me. And I know in general, you're going to end it in one of two ways. And I'm going to feel, you know, I'm going to feel, for the most part, the way I feel at the end of most movies. You don't know what the fuck is going to happen in a documentary or in a nonfiction book or an unscripted series. You are the ones that are the most ridiculous, right? Like, the end of Jinx, if it were scripted, would be fucking ridiculous, you know? So you can things like that. And they, certain things like, I love Survivor. Some things that happen on Survivor, if scripted, would be absurd. Yeah. But the fact that they happen in real life like that, the way they happen is thrilling. So I do think it does go a little more. It goes beyond kind of a how did this all happen? And for me, it's always like a can you believe how it all happened?
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, I mean it's not to use a trite saying, but you know, truth is stranger than fiction as well. And I do find that, you know, when you're reading nonfiction, at least for me, I find it either A, inspiring, or B, just mind blowing that it happened. Like that's just fascinating to me. And to your point, Kenny, when you're seeing these documentaries and you're seeing the way that these things play out, and by the way, like, you know, I'm watching the Pretend It's a City right now, the Fran Lebowitz thing, which is, I mean, it's unbelievable. Girl. It's the best. I mean, that's a documentary, but like, I'm just enjoying being in a world with a person who sees the world the way she does. And that in and of itself is part of why I think Errol Morris's stuff is so fascinating to me. Like, I don't like Fred. I don't want to spend any fucking time with this guy, you know, in person. But the way he sees the world is fascinating. And the way he's lived his life is fascinating. So I don't know. I mean, I guess my question to you, Simon, would be, you know, you've, as we mentioned, you've done a handful of documentaries yourself. You know, when you approach them, I guess my question is, are you learning as you go along? Or do you know everything about your subject before you sit down to actually do a documentary?
Oh, my God. The first one.
Right.
100%. There's no possible way to know everything about it. I mean, I guess I've never made a historical documentary that was like, you know, that was all just like archival footage and just telling the story of a person who lived 100 years ago or whatever, where you actually would kind of know the stuff. Even then, it's a process of uncovering things. But yeah, no, absolutely not. I mean, I think that what makes documentary so exciting is that you're basically following a mystery. It may not be like a whodunit, but it's just about learning a bit more and a bit more and a bit more, asking questions, figuring out what the hell's going on. And what I think makes good documentaries, at least the kind of documentaries I like so much and the kind that we're talking about, and Errol Morris specifically, and he was the one that really created this, you know, way of doing things, is the freedom to follow a story, the freedom to follow a character, and do that in an open-ended way that can lead you down a path that you would never have expected, as well as doing a lot of things you're not talking about right now, which is imposing a lot of filmmaking onto that.
Sure.
Because we're experiencing this story as Errol Morris sees it, or as Agnes Varda would, or as Fred Wiseman would. And you have somebody like Frederick Wiseman, who is like the sort of godfather of like fly on the wall verite kind of stuff. He's totally one of my heroes too, even though that's, I'm a lot more excited by the Errol Morris style, the like more arch, the more stylized, the more visually stunning, the more dreamlike kind of stuff. But Wiseman, who I'm actually like loving more and more now as he's in his 90s and making 3.5 hour long movies about the New York Public Library or Boston City Hall. That was his movie last year.
Wow.
Back in the day, back when we were in university, Frederick Wiseman would have been pointed to as somebody that the film professors would say, like, that's real documentary because it's true and it's objective. And it's all these things that Errol Morris, with all his weird stylization, is not. And I would say, and I think people realize this now, that you can be as verite and as fly in the wall as possible, as Wiseman is, and those films are still unbelievably personal and subjective in that you have this particular guy pointing the camera here, not there, editing this, not that. There is no real objective truth in documentary filmmaking. There are just sort of levels of how you present things. Obviously, facts are facts. Those are real things. The Holocaust did happen. But how you show reality is very personal and is totally wildly fluctuates from one filmmaker to another. And it's like a beautiful kind of alchemy that you're dealing with real people, you're following a story, you don't necessarily know what you're doing. And then even in just simple stylistic ways, you're, as a filmmaker, reacting to it and that interplay. And the way Errol Morris does it is amazing. And funnily enough, I just flash back to when we were in film school together, and second year was documentary. I had no interest in making documentaries. I didn't until a few years after that. I'd loved some. And talking about, the Errol Morris or Werner Herzog documentary style thing, and the teacher like screaming at me and being like, those are all fake things. Those are like, that's not real. Errol Morris should go back to doing the Thin Blue Line, not just like dealing with these weirdos and whatever. And it's like, in the end, what happened? Turn on any Netflix documentary. And it's all Errol Morris.
Your teacher's a bad teacher. It may be a bad person. certainly a bad artist. I think you're 100% right. And it feels dismissive to films from people like Frederick Wiseman and other more fly on the wall type documentarians to say that's not art, that's just documenting. In fact, I think even the term documentary is a little misleading, right?
Yeah.
It really, these are necessarily editorials, right? These would not be on the front page of newspapers. These would be in the op-ed section, which is where they belong. You are trying to make an argument no matter what, through every decision you've made. Like you said, Simon, the lighting is a decision. The camera angles is a decision. Music you play in the background is a decision. Everything is a decision that will make the audience feel a certain way. And obviously, these are bigger decisions, but it's no different from writing a persuasive essay. The words you use, that's a decision. You're trying to make the audience feel a certain way. I have a question about documentaries in general. I think that this... Phil, we talk about 99 obviously every week on this podcast, almost always through the lens of what a great year it was for scripted films, for adult films. But we have noticed, there's some revolutionary kids films in this movie. I mean, in this year, and there have been amazing shows. There's been music, but whatever. There were a lot of documentaries made in 1999 that have stood the test of time. There's this. We did Buena Vista Social Club. There is Beyond the Mat, which we did. One Day in September, I think, it has staying power. I think there are
other American Movie and American Pimp are both
American Movie. Yes, American Movie and American Pimp. Yes, both movies that still have, you know, some relevance and reverence in certain corners. So, what was it about this moment in American? And the other thing is, most of the movies we named are not prestige documentaries, right?
Correct.
Like, I understand Buena Vista won the Oscar and One Day in September is your typical kind of Oscar documentary movie. But a lot of these have a pop vibe that you didn't see out of documentaries that made it into like the outskirts of the mainstream. So what was it about this moment and documentary filmmaking that broke through?
I mean, I'm just going to hazard a guess in the sense that it felt, I mean, and this feels like a cheap answer, and we say it all the time, but being at the end of a millennium, this turning of the page, this sort of people feeling like it was an opportunity to be able to look backwards at sort of the, you know, almost 2,000 years that we had up until this point, felt like, you know, obviously rich terrain. In terms of this specific batch of documentaries, which does cover the gamut. I mean, from Mr. Death to American Pimp to American Movie. I mean, these are all very, very different movies. I can only speak for myself when it comes to American Movie. And I remember Simon and I were big fans of it back in 99. You know, if you're in film school and that movie lands, I mean, obviously it's going to speak to you. Yesterday on Twitter, apropos of nothing, someone I follow started talking about how they just watched American Movie for the first time and had like a whole thread of like 10 tweets about, you know, how amazing this film is. I think that it's just a weird lightning in a bottle moment, but I look to you, Simon, to a certain degree as to what alchemy might have been in the ether in that moment that you think might have led to this confluence of films.
Well, I'm not sure exactly. I was just looking up Agnes Varda's filmography because I thought that The Gleaner's Nine might have been 1999, but it was 2000, so it was close.
Right.
Which was sort of another big movie for her. The thing that, I mean, I don't know. I'd have to look at a couple of years before and after. I don't know that 1999 was a particularly amazing year for documentaries, like more so than a 98 or 2001
sure.
or something. I'd have to look. But the thing that when you started talking about that moment there that really jumped into my mind is, if it's not the last year, it's about the last year where all the movies that you just mentioned, except for Beyond the Mat, were shot on film.
Right, right.
It's right before video really took over feature documentaries. Might have been another couple of years before it was fully there, and then it was another few years before you could actually even make it look good. Mm-hmm. But it's so, I mean, like it completely blows my mind that something like American Movie would have been shot on film. I mean, as yeah. somebody that's made a feature film following, a feature documentary film following regular people like Mark and Mike in American Movie, having to think about how expensive film is while you're doing that is just completely mind-blowing to me. I cannot imagine, as a documentary filmmaker, having to actually do that. Mm-hmm. With this movie, with Mr. Death, I realized something because, and we haven't talked about the Interatron yet, which is the way that Errol Morris does these interviews. So he does these interviews that are, you know, straight to camera. The subject is looking right down mm-hmm. the barrel. And the way he achieves that is he basically has a two-camera teleprompter system where Fred is looking at what is a teleprompter that is projecting an image of Errol Morris's face, and behind that is the camera lens. And Errol Morris is looking at a teleprompter with Fred's face from the camera that was behind the other one, and he has a camera.
So it's like they're having a conversation.
So they're looking into each other's eyes on video. They're basically on Zoom. They're basically doing this right now, only they can't see themselves. So, mm-hmm. the, so I knew about this technology. I never used it. I actually often use a cheaper version called the iDirect that's literally just done with mirrors. That's mm-hmm. the same thing. It's almost like an old stage magician mirror trick that is super cool and really gets great effects. But I knew that he was doing this, and I realized that the interview that he was doing, if you look at it, it was actually shot on video and then transferred to film. It was like the TV was either filmed or whatever, but I could see the video artifacts in the close-up of Fred Lucher. And that makes a lot more sense to me, because you can run however much video. He's probably shooting like Beta SP or something like that, like some broadcast standard video at the time. He's shooting that and then editing offline and then transferring the last bit to film. But then all the stylized stuff is when he's actually shooting film, and that's the stuff that Robert Richardson shot. So I okay. can kind of understand like how he's beginning to weave this film and digital technology together that within a couple of years would be so much more easy to handle and allow you to do so much more.
I mean, you just said Robert Richardson. I didn't know Robert Richardson shot this. Like, I didn't know that Robert Richardson shot Errol Morris's movies, which says, you know, a lot.
He shot Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control, and he shot parts of this. I'm sure he didn't shoot the...
Right. Yeah. The interview.
The interviews, but I mean, there's look at all the stuff beautiful. with the crazy blown out overhead lighting.
Yeah.
When I was watching it last night, the stuff in the diner of him drinking the coffee, mm-hmm. it looks like Natural Born Killers.
I was literally just gonna say, as I was watching it last night, the hot lighting and even Lucher, who feels a little bit like Tommy Lee Jones in Natural Born Killers, that I was just like, why is this? And that it totally makes sense. Like that now it really does look like Natural Born Killers.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure is intentional. Oh.
Got a dog.
Which I'm sure is intentional. No worries. Yeah, I mean, I think that that would be quite the double bill, actually. Natural Born Killers in this movie. That would actually be an interesting double bill of watching those two films next to each other. But it actually also kind of brings the Oliver Stone-ness. Also, kind of feels.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare insurance plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare insurance plans at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Like, Oliver Stone is trading in his version of facts, right? In his mm-hmm. version of history. He's not a documentary filmmaker. And yet, if you took
he's
a poll...
He's made a couple of documentaries.
Sure. But, like, I'm curious about your thoughts on this too, Kenny, because I know that, like, we have similar feelings about Oliver Stone, I think. Maybe I'm wrong. But, like, I love some of his movies, and I kind of despise some of his movies. You know, a movie that I think Kenny and I both agree with, and I don't know what your thoughts are on it, but Nixon, for instance, is, I think, a great film that attempts to sort of get inside the head of a very complicated and broken soul. I think there are people that watch biopics, if we're going to consider it a biopic, and think that this is like a documentary. And that's where we come back almost full circle to where we were talking about earlier, which is like the perception of truth, the perception of what's being put out in the world, watching something on a movie screen and thinking that it's real. You know, that's why, like, there are people that think The Crown should have a disclaimer in front of it saying that it isn't, you know, that it isn't a doc, which is insane to me. But, like, we've got to that place. What do you think that says about where we are, Kenny?
I think it says that people are really stupid.
I think that's what I think.
And I think that's obvious to some extent. Sure. I think people are assholes. I think people love to cry foul whenever they have the opportunity to cry foul. You said a lot there. So yeah. We're gonna have to cut this. My daughter just FaceTimed me. Okay. And I just declined that shit for this podcast.
Hold on. Let me just respond to her.
Okay.
So I think it says that people are really stupid is the original thought. Yes. And I think we've gotten to the place where people just love to cry foul over anything if they can cry foul. And it's very laborious. The Oliver Stone thing is interesting to me. Going back 20, 25 years, I've always been a kind of staunch defender of him, mm-hmm. particularly films like Nixon, JFK, and Born on the 4th of July, Platoon. The idea being it is not his responsibility to teach you about history. It is not even his responsibility to present the truth. It's just his responsibility to make a piece of art he's happy with. That's really the end of it, or not happy with. Yep. So I think that's a lot easier of a case to make with something that is scripted. And people just have to start to understand that that's, you know, obviously the case with something like something that is kind of clearly taking liberties, like a Nixon or a JFK, something that's trying to be closer to the true story, but it's impossible to do that. Or something that, you know, something like The Crown, which is kind of evolving as the series goes along, you know, having written on something, Sun Records, that was taken from history, you know, it's about Elvis, Johnny Cash, and Jerry Lee Lewis. There, and we tried to be true to life. There's only so much you can do. Yeah. There's only so much that you know. And you just have to accept that as a viewer. Now, I would extend this to documentaries. It's not the documentarian's job to tell you the truth. It's not the documentarian's job to give you the facts. It's not the documentarian's job to do anything other than make something that they find compelling. And it's your job to be skeptical and to interrogate that and to find what you think is truthful or what you think is worthwhile out of that as well. So anything that presupposes that you're supposed to learn from this piece of art that's not explicitly educational, and I would put those on a, you know, kind of another plane where their honest to goodness attempt is to teach. Has to be taken in that same way. It's a piece of art.
Well, you know, it's funny you say that because I, as you were talking there, I was thinking about how much audiences hate to be challenged, right? Like most audiences, if it's sitting on your couch in your TV room or sitting in a movie theater, want either an escape or something that isn't going to make them think too much, right? I mean, I think that, and I would even extend that to people that do, to some degree or another, go see documentaries, right? I mean, I don't know that a lot of people go to see a documentary and then go home and do research to fill in the blanks or to fill out the picture or to educate them so they are, that their knowledge of this person is more sort of, you know, rounded. I think that, unfortunately, it feels like most people want art to be pleasurable. And that doesn't necessarily need to be a bad thing, but I do think that it sort of comes back to sort of this initial thing you were talking about not just people being stupid, but people being lazy, people just not applying themselves to art. They only
it's
want
okay to, you know. To be. It's okay to be lazy. It's not okay. It's not okay to then act as if you know everything.
Right. Well, sure. Yeah. You know? Yes. Exactly. Yes. Own it. Yeah.
Yeah. Go home and be. Hey, if you don't want to read more about Fred Leicher, great, but don't start coming on a podcast and telling me, you know, we had some good ideas.
Kenny, I totally, totally, totally agree with you. I couldn't have put it better myself. The only line, and it's so funny that I'm gonna actually kind of say something against it a little bit because I basically am 150% with you. And our old documentary teacher would hate you just as much as she would.
Good.
Scatter. But I think that the only time that there is a line, you said educational stuff, sure. If there is a presumption of, and this is a slippery term anyway, but a presumption of like journalistic integrity, that can be a line too. But for the most part, a movie is just a movie, whether or not it's a documentary or if it's a narrative film or whatever. And yeah, you're just, you know, your responsibility is to yourself as an artist and to whatever, to the audience, however you define that and however much you want to play to whatever audience it is.
And I think that's a good point, Simon. And the slipperiness of that term shouldn't preclude people from trying to understand what is and what is not an attempt at straight journalism, and what is an attempt at editorializing. And I think, you know, I can't think of too many films, feature films meant for theatrical release that play in that journalistic, that journalistic sandbox.
Yeah.
And in fact, I'm tempted to say none of them do, because I don't want to box any film in like that. I'm thinking of a film, for instance, a really, really good movie called, I think it was called Bully, about the kids who were getting bullied at school, which does kind of present itself in a journalistic way, in an, you know, kind of an on the ground reporting. This is what happens in our schools. But even that, I would say that's just a piece of the puzzle. You know, that's just a piece of the puzzle, and who knows exactly what biases are or what was left out or what was put in. Do a little more research and, you know, take this argument as it comes to you.
Or just wait for the next Q drop and you know, that'll tell you what you need to know.
Yeah.
What do you think? Actually, this just had me thinking of, I mean, the biggest documentary as of late that completely played fast and loose with the truth, the Scorsese Dylan doc from 2 years ago. Have you guys seen that? Which is
literally, I haven't seen that.
It's on Netflix, Rolling Thunder Review. It's one of my favorite documentaries of the last few years, and it is at least 30% complete lies, completely made up. Like Sharon Stone is interviewed saying that she was a groupie on this Dylan tour in 1972. She was never there. There's a filmmaker that's interviewed, a Belgian filmmaker, I think, who was, you know, apparently shooting all of the footage that they're now cutting together of this Rolling Thunder Review tour, did not exist. At one point, there's a former U.S. senator interviewed about it. That is literally a character from Robert Altman's film Tanner 88. It's literally, and it's amazing. But mixed in with that is actual footage of Dylan and Joan Baez and all these people on tour in the 70s. And there's a Dylan interview now, which involves some truth and some lies, and it's complete alchemy.
But is Scorsese,
and it's amazing?
Is Scorsese? He's aware of the falsehoods, right? Like he's mixing them in intentionally inside the truth, right? See, I don't know if either of you have seen. Did you see Stories We Tell, the Sarah Pauley movie? Like that to me is sort of also a distillation of everything we're talking about. This idea of what is truth, what is memory, you know. Does it matter that something isn't true if it's a memory that you believe in? Like, you know what I mean? Like, if it helps your relationship to either with a person who's alive or a person who's dead. I mean, these are all just sort of, this is all kind of the stuff that kicks around in your head about, like, you know, our existence, I guess, and you know, what is important to us and what isn't important to us. I think that, you know, and again, this speaks perfectly to this film as well, which is playing with the ideas of you know, history and what is real history and what actually happened. I mean, clearly millions and millions of Jews were killed, and there are people that want to believe that that didn't happen or want to twist themselves into pretzels as to, you know, whatever. obviously I take umbrage and issue with those people, but if that helps them get out of bed in the morning and gives them some semblance of guidance or whatever, I'm not necessarily sure that I hate that notion, right? Like, I mean, I think that, well, I just mean in the sense that, like,
what notion?
I think this idea of...
You better clarify that one. Yeah.
I guess what I'm saying is I think that people believe what they're going to believe. And I don't think that people should believe in falsehoods. I don't think that people should believe in things that obviously didn't happen. But I also think that everyone has some compass inside them that gives them some sense of self. And I'm not in any way obviously denying or believing that a Holocaust denier should be allowed to deny the Holocaust. I mean, they're allowed to, I guess, freedom of speech and what have you, but like, I don't know. I come back to this. Sorry, go ahead.
It's a different question. Like, you're hitting on some really interesting things. You know, okay, you do get to a place where the word allowed is pretty loaded, right?
Sure.
So should a Holocaust denier be allowed to deny the Holocaust? Well, shit, I don't know the answer to that. Like, I don't think that's a very simple question. I think that, you know, I feel like I know a lot of people who would say, yes, of course they should be allowed. And then I think there are some people, and I don't really know where I fall in, who would say, of course they should not be allowed. That's too dangerous of a thought to be even in the public sphere. You're not allowed to believe that in Germany. I completely understand why that is, or you're not allowed to publicly espouse that in Germany. I understand why that's the case. So how you kind of got into this muck, Phil, was interesting in and of itself. Like, or does society have the right to impose any kind of limits on free thought, free speech, free thought? Like, obviously there are limits on free speech that, like, everybody kind of agrees with, but are there any limits?
Not Twitter, apparently.
What's that?
Not Twitter, apparently. I mean, we get into these weird, I mean, we had this with Trump, right? We had this where he's not only espousing misinformation, but that it's dangerous and that it will lead to violence, right? Like, at some point, are we not supposed to have lines in the sand? I don't know the answer to this. I'm really just, you know, just talking.
Well, the difference between America and Canada is interesting. And it's very interesting that the Ernst Zundel trial that is in this film, Mr. Death, that was taking place in Toronto. That, do you remember that, Phil, when
vaguely,
you were a kid?
I do.
That,
yeah, I do.
It happened a little bit, like, when I think it was 88 or 89. So we were, like, very young. But then throughout the 90s, it kept kind of bubbling up in it. And it's kind of fascinating because in Canada, and I think they even say in the movie, it's a very little used law, because we basically have free speech here, but I guess what convicted Zundel is publishing a pamphlet that denies the Holocaust. The steps that you take one after that is an incitement of violence against Jews, because if the Holocaust didn't happen, then why did we say it happened? Because Jews made it up, and then they're trying to, you know, control people or do whatever, and that's bad. And so whoever is the audience for this pamphlet then needs to go out there and fight and stop Jews from doing this, and that can lead to violence. So that's why Zundel went on trial and was found guilty despite Fred Lutcher trying to help. I remember when that was happening too, one person that I don't think in the trial, but wrote about that situation and was saying that Zundel should be able to publish this stuff, was actually Noam Chomsky, who
is
a figure on the left, a Jew, who, you know, is the complete opposite of a Nazi, and was saying that, you know, this pamphlet he's written and publishing is completely wrong, is totally abhorrent, and is awful, but I believe free speech is an absolute, and so he should have the right to do it. It's kind of like, I have sympathy towards that, but I also have sympathy, like, you know, people shouldn't be hurt, especially based on hate and bullshit.
I have, my default position is that too. My default position is protect free speech at all costs. It should be the last thing that goes down. And Phil, we've talked about this a million times. You know, like it comes up over and over again, how much I'm uncomfortable with the idea of censorship in any form. It is something, it's not really existential. I'm going to be fine, but it's existential for our business. It's existential for what we do to be able to be able to feel like we can talk about whatever we want within the confines of our art without it being censored or taken down. This isn't to say that I'm against quote unquote canceling people, which I think is also an expression of free speech.
Sure.
Like I think that's an important distinction to make, that, you know, if you're going to put things out into the public sphere, you could also be taken down by people within the public sphere. Question is now when you get the government issues that, and we're seeing it play out a little bit right now at this moment with Marjorie Taylor Greene, who has said some incredibly incendiary things like we should kill Nancy Pelosi within the last 2 years. And it would be government at this point removing her based on things she has said in the past. Now, like, I see the slippery slope there. You know, I certainly see the slippery slope where, you know, she said something horrible in the last 2 years. Could we get to the point where someone who said something horrible 20 years ago could be in trouble? Could you get to the point where someone like Robert Byrd, who is a reformed KKK member, wound up being quite a liberal New Jersey Democratic senator, would he be subject to that? Are you allowed to change? These are really kind of case by case things. The whole thing makes me very uncomfortable. I just kind of want to scream, can't we just all be nice to each other and not be dicks? This starts at a real young age.
It goes without saying that this country continues to evolve and is at a real crossroads that we're hopefully, you know, we'll find our way down the right path. But freedom of speech is unbelievably important, and I'm certainly in no way suggesting that it should be censored or truncated. But it just
Robert Byrd was from West Virginia. Sorry.
Okay. very different than New Jersey.
Well, at the time, but yes.
But I think that it all comes back to this film. It all comes back to this idea of this man of science, or claimed to be a man of science, claimed it anyway. I'm not, you know, obviously suggesting that he was good at it or that he was particularly scientifically based, but this man who, you know, believed himself to be doing good when it came to his executions and when it came to these things.
And when it came to going to Auschwitz and chiseling bits of the wall out and testing it for cyanide and then saying that the Holocaust could never happen. He thought he was doing good.
I'd love to know what he thought they were doing with these rooms. But that's neither here nor there. You know, it's logic be damned with something like this, but, you know.
I want to throw something else out there. I love this. I love a movie like this that kind of sets up so many interesting questions. Doesn't give you the answers, but part of art. So I would say that Fred Leicher was he was a man of science. I think that's a fair thing to say. And I think it's also fair to say he was probably best in his field. I think what's really important is that there was nobody in his field. Right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So he was the best of nobody. He was the best of one guy. What's the guy's name? The Holocaust denier?
Zundel. Ernst Zundel.
All right. So when Ernst Zundel, and he's...
Perfect name, by the way. I mean, just the
When Ernst Zundel is interviewed on camera, which is kind of an amazing thing, he says that Fred Leicher is the only person in the world who has the skills to do this. That may have been kind of true. Now, I'm not saying, obviously, there are other people. Let me kind of amend that. There are other, obviously, people who are better, who have a better understanding of what would be left behind when you have a cyanide filled room. But there is one person who is probably the foremost expert in the world on gas lethal injections, or at least that's a reasonable claim to make. The point I'm making is, and it's a long way of getting here, this is going to sound like I'm coming down one way, but I'm just throwing it out there. I am very anti death penalty. I think it's revolting and abhorrent. In the movie, Fred Leitcher says something to the effect of, there are a lot of people who won't work on these machines because they find it to be morally repugnant. My guess is that's a lot of the best people, if not most of the best people, right? There might be like just how you're not going to find a lot of great scientists who are on the side of climate denialism. And that's why you have all these crappy papers from these idiots from universities you've never heard of, while everybody with any kind of expertise in this field is on the other side. However, execution is real in this country. It's an actual thing that actually happens. And it is incumbent upon us as a society to do it in the most humane way possible. Do the people who would have otherwise been the best at this have a moral obligation to make execution as humane as possible? Or do they have a moral obligation to abstain from the process altogether?
I would say abstain. I mean, you take that energy, take that time, take whatever, and try and fight against capital punishment. I mean, you know, you are supporting the system by even if you're doing ways to make it more humane.
And I feel like I'm playing devil's advocate because I wouldn't work on this, but it's that system that gets you to a place where the giants on the other side are the Fred Leitchers, just like the giants on the other side right now are Stephen Miller's and Seb Gorka's. And those are the people being taken seriously by the other side. Now I'm not saying that there's equivalency there, but when you have a side that's basically devoid of any rigorous intellectualism, you wind up with these true believing phonies and fraudsters and monsters. And I think that's dangerous in its own right.
Well, yeah, that's totally true. I do want to clarify, because I'm sure that, like, I mean, we had a lot of trouble finding a copy of this movie right now. It's not particularly in print. So you guys have both been referring to Lucher as a man of science. He is an uncredited electrical engineer that fell into also getting into lethal injection and gallows. He's an electrical engineer. That's all he is. That's not a scientist. That's not somebody that does lab testing. That's not whatever. He talks about how when he got into lethal injection machines and gas chambers, he just did a bunch of reading, because his name as the expert on electric chairs just got him other jobs. He wasn't trained in all this stuff at all. He's a self-made man.
I think it's fair to say he's about as much a man of science as Stephen Miller is a man of immigration. he has some guesses, and a lot of gum and, you know, popsicle sticks there. So point well taken, Simon. But I would double down a little bit by saying, thank God he is so much of a fraud, an obvious fraud. So thank God he's so much of an obvious charlatan, even if he doesn't realize it. Because the scary thing to me is what happens when they get some good, you know?
I would also love to know how this field, and I'll put that in quotation marks because I'm not sure what the right, you know, way to describe it is, has evolved since 99. I mean,
there are no more gallows, for instance.
Well, there are no more gallows. There's no more electric chairs, correct?
The way it works, as far as I understand, is you can be killed by whatever methods are legal at the time of your sentencing, or maybe of your crime being committed.
Okay.
So you'd have a situation where there probably weren't, gallows were probably not even allowed in 1999. But yes. People who did something in 1979 and said, right. I would prefer to be killed via, you know, the gallows instead of lethal injection had the opportunity. I remember when we were younger, in middle school, the last person who was legally killed by a firing squad, that happened. Because that person had committed the crime in the 70s or 80s or something along those lines. That being said, having seen the way these people die from these other methods, give me the firing squad.
I was going to ask, we should all pick our own. How are we all going to be?
I thought about it. I think the firing squad is the move.
It might be.
The thing with the firing squad is what I'd want is to be riddled with bullets.
Yeah.
I'd want like slow 50 motion people doves. Shooting me at the same time with John Woo doves. What they do, or my understanding again, I feel like I know too much about this, but what they do is they have like five guys shooting, four guys have blanks, and one guy has the real bullet, so they don't know who's actually shooting. Hmm. So yeah, you get one between the eyes.
I mean, I mean, ultimately, I would just come down on whatever is the quickest, ultimately. Yeah. But do you want to rate this movie? It's hard to rate this movie, but let me say
I'm going to go.
Oh, sorry, Simon. I thought you did. My apologies.
It's funny because my wife and I had this conversation as soon as the movie ended. I frankly, like, you know, maybe it's a little too vintage or whatever, but I say, and it's for the quickness thing, give me the guillotine.
Guillotine. I like
guillotine's
it.
Boom. Fast.
Fast. Just done.
That's actually a really good answer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I mean, it's...
Give me the guillotine.
The guillotine is the fastest. Why'd they stop using that? Too medieval?
Too gross. Gruesome, I guess.
Yeah, probably.
All right.
I think there's probably a Christian thing about keeping the body intact. That's just a guess based on my understanding of Christianity.
So in 99, I saw this film. I liked this film. I probably would have given it an 85 back in 99. I think that I liked it. Again, like this is, I texted Kenny after he was done. I was like, did you like it? And he was like, I mean, as much as one can like him. Like, this is a hard movie to sort of.
You said, did you like it as much? I mean, as much as one could like it. I said, that's the right answer because that's the right answer.
Yeah. Before this, watching it yesterday, as I said, it was a harder experience. So it was, I can't say that I liked it more, but I respected it more. And I think I'm at like high 80s. I'm probably at a 90 now, something in that vicinity of a film that any film that can afford us, as Kenny said, the opportunity to be able to talk about these things that lays out complex, interesting, notions with a character that is fascinating in his own way is a good movie. It's a great movie, right? Like that's all we should strive for when it comes to cinema, as far as I'm concerned. As long as it makes you think a little bit and it gives you opportunities to be able to talk with friends about things, great. So I'm probably at a 90. Where do you think you lie, Kenny?
You know, it's funny. I forgot that I had rated this in the moment. because sometimes I do and sometimes I don't. I rated it a 78. I don't exactly know why I went that low because I'm going to go higher right now.
Yeah.
I don't know. I thought that was a good grade, but it feels a lot better than that to me after this conversation. Yeah. I'm going to go all the way up to a 90. I think it's really a tremendous, tremendous film. So resonant, so important. There are things we didn't even really discuss about the way a character is built throughout the piece. I think there is a really interesting kind of cinematic turn with this character.
Oh, yeah.
And I think... I hope I'm not undercutting my point. I think that this is a very responsible film. Again, you don't have to be responsible necessarily, but bonus points if you are. And I think it's a really responsible way of telling this story. And I would never have any hesitancy about showing this to anybody, which could be a pitfall with a film about this particular subject. So I'm going to give it a 90.
Yeah, I mean, I want to agree and I want to piggyback on it just for a second and just to say about how – you know, how the film is structured, how the film is how he delineates this man to us in that first half an hour is just so vitally important. You know, he seems quirky. He seems like a guy that you're kind of, it's so important that he not just gets his hooks in you, but that he feels like a human being who has, you know, who has the best of intentions under the circumstances. And then to cut sort of to pull the rug out from underneath you and do this deep dive, you know, into this. Like a lesser filmmaker, I think, would have kept him quirky longer and wouldn't have gone as deep into the Holocaust denial component of it. And I think that it's a testament to Errol Morris as a filmmaker that that the percentages are the way that they are.
They might have done it the other way around. It might have been mostly just about the Lucha report and the Zindel case, and then a little with you know, mm-hmm. a little bit of background. But yeah, it's amazing how that happened. I didn't think about this beforehand. I would probably say I'm going to give it a 95. Mm-hmm. I'm rating it very highly. I mean, I think it's an amazing piece of art. I think it's an amazing piece of filmmaking. I think that it just makes you think and think and think and ask all kinds of questions. And that's about the best thing that a movie and especially a documentary can do. It's funny, at the time I saw it, would have in 99, it would have been on my top 10 list for sure. Now, I mean, Morris's style, and it wasn't just this film, but it's like this film, Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control, and The Thin Blue Line. His style was so revolutionary then and has been so influential now that in a way this movie loses a bit of something because you see this style everywhere. Whereas in 1999, this was, you know, the second or third movie to ever actually have a style like this. So I remember seeing it then and just being completely blown away because, I mean, even, you know, the way that the Robert Richardson shot, you know, character, stylized character pieces were. Now you see things like that, maybe not as good, but now you see things like that. You did not see things like that then. And it just kind of blows me away. So do I dock it points in 2021 because now it doesn't look so unique, or do I continue giving it those points because it was opened so things up in a way
Give it the points.
So I'm going to give it the points. I'm going to give it a 95. I'll settle with that. There was one quote that I read that I thought was pretty interesting. Somebody was likening or just, you know, bring up the comparison because of the subject matter between this movie and Schindler's List. And Errol Morris made an interesting point about it, which was, you know, Schindler's List, one of the things that's about is about how any man can be a hero. Mm-hmm. And this movie is about how any man can think he's a hero.
Yeah.
I thought that was a pretty excellent.
No, I think that Fred absolutely thinks himself to be a hero. I mean, even at the end, he feels like, you know, he feels he is being treated unjustly, which makes him, I mean, that much more of a fascinating fool, but.
I believe he is alive. Is that correct?
I don't know. Maybe.
I was thinking of Googling him, but I didn't.
He is alive. He is still alive. So I wonder what's going on now in his life. It doesn't seem like there's much on Wikipedia about anything in the, you know, pretty much since 1990. But yeah, he's alive and living somewhere. That's kind of interesting in its own right.
That's crazy.
Especially considering the coffee and cigarettes.
Yeah.
Exactly. All that being said, Simon, thank you for being on.
Yes, thank you. It was fun. It was great to have you on for this.
It was so great to have you back to talk about a great movie that I'm thrilled we got to cover again. We hope that you'll come back. We hope that you'll come back for and maybe come on our Patreon as well for an 89 movie or something like that. We'd love to have you back. So thank you so
anytime.
Much.
Anytime. You know I love you, Phil and Kenny. I'm very fond of you.
Oh, I appreciate that. I'm fond of you as well.
Well, to our listeners, please rate, review, subscribe. Thank you to Ernie and Will for producing this episode. Thank you to Jan for our key art and our theme music. Thank you to Sullivan for doing our social media. Thank you for listening. And please check out our Patreon podcast, I guess, 1989, where we are covering the films of 1989. Thank you so much. Like it's 1989.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.